Matt, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Lorna.
Hello!
If you never heard the podcast before, we both do a report, one or two.
Recently.
Or three, yep. On a moment, person, event.
Something from history.
Something from history. And last week we decided to do a podcast on photography. Very important development in the history of history. So, the history of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we ended up actually deciding to do a two-part little series.
Yes.
Last week we did Alberto Korda's Che Guevara. And we also covered Tank Man by five different photographers.
Jeff, Stuart, Charlie, all of
Charlie
them.
Charlie Cole.
Charlie Cole, Stuart Franklin.
There you go.
Jeff Widener, maybe.
Okay.
Struggled with his surname, I'm not going to lie.
This week, we've continued that, as I said, and we've got a report each. Short report, 20 minutes. On on another important...
Famous image,
and again, a story. The image you may know, but the story you may not.
Yep.
That's what we're all about, isn't it?
You may also not know the image, but it is in the top.
Oh yeah, so
100 or whatever, and in that case, it will be tweeted out.
Yeah. So last week, you probably, if you live in the Western world, you're of a certain age, you'll probably have come across both the Che Guevara photo and the Tank Man image.
Yes.
This week, we've got a photo on my end which I have come across, but is not as big in my sort of sphere, my world, as it probably is in America, at least was in America in the 20th century. And yours, I believe...
I've never come across it.
Never
before,
come across it. I don't think.
Apparently,
no.
It's really famous, so I roll by anyway.
So, do you want to crack on with your report?
Yes. So it's 1948, and Philippe. I'll call him Phil.
Yeah.
Holzman was a photographer, and he was about to create a famous and groundbreaking image. And I've put, although I doubt many people will be aware of or have seen this image, unlike those we discussed last week. Holzman had been born in Riga in 1906, which had been part of the Russian Empire at the time, and he first began his career as a fashion photographer, and he developed a reputation as one of the best portrait photographers in France.
It's very similar to last week, Alberto Korda, who covered Che Guevara, he was a fashion photographer as well.
Yeah, it seems like there must be quite a lot of work.
Yeah, probably.
It's a commercial work as well. It's in demand rather than artistic or creative in their own styles. So he'd moved to Paris. He was shooting fashion photography, which is a good place, if you ask me, to be.
Yeah.
He then moved from fashion and cosmetics onto photojournalism, and he photographed 101 Life magazine covers, which is pretty impressive.
I thought you were going to say 101 Dalmatians.
No. We might have done. I don't know if he took pictures of any dogs. It didn't come up. From the little bit of research I did, his life was very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And I've put it's worth the focus of a future pod report, probably.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Lived quite a life.
Yeah, but... Well, a lot of it I've picked up in here, but there are important aspects.
Mm.
But I have left bits out, but I will refer to something later on.
Okay. That's very vague.
Very intriguing.
Vague. Oh, interesting.
So, he became a popular photographer, and his life work became... his own goal was to capture the essence and the spirit of those he photographed, and he's now notorious for capturing this spirit.
Notorious?
Yeah, so okay. he's well known apparently, famous, but I've not heard of him. So he liked to capture the spirit and the character of people that he was taking images of, and this became a challenge when his next task was to capture a portrait of Salvador Dali. For those that may not know him, Salvador Dali was a prominent Spanish surrealist. He's also worth his own pod report because he's a very interesting guy. He was born in Figueres, Catalonia in 1904, and his full name is Salvador Domingo Felipe Jacinto Dali y Dominic.
Yeah.
He was the first Marquis of Dali de Pobwell. So that's where he's from.
The first Marquis.
Pobwell.
Okay.
Pobwell. Some of that.
So does that mean he's sort of noble born sort of thing?
No, it was a title which was awarded by King Juan Carlos in 1982.
Oh, okay.
So he was that prominent in Spain that he got his own title.
Wait.
And he, I read this, but I haven't wrote it down. He requested that, the title was going to be hereditary, but he requested that it ended with his death. So there is not, there's nobody else that's got that title.
So I'm thinking, in my head, that would, to me, be like, oh, that's quite modest, being like, oh, we're not going to pass it on, like, it'll land here. But I have no Salvador Dali, so it's not very modest.
I also don't think that's modest.
Do you know?
I think modest would be to pass it on, to share it.
Maybe. But yeah, it's not. It's
I don't... Yeah, he wasn't very modest.
He's just outside of Barcelona, like, isn't it? It's
Catalonia, yeah.
Well, it's in Catalonia, so... yeah, there's some Salvador Dali accessories just by our side here.
Yeah, Matt's a big fan. So, Dali's best known for bizarre images and surrealist work, and it's very striking. His art repertoire includes film, sculpture, photography, and mixing medias whilst collaborating with a wide range of other artists. I would definitely have a Google, because I don't think it's like anything else you'll see.
Yeah, surrealist,
isn't
it?
He's best known for The Persistence of Memory, which is a painting he completed in 1931. It's now often referenced in popular culture, and it's been given other names such as The Melting Clocks or The Soft Watches. The painting was shown at the Julian Levy Gallery, and it's then been with the MoMA collection since 1934.
Right, okay.
So,
I'm not sure
the Museum of Modern Art.
I'm not sure if I came across that in my trip to MoMA. So very big. I think we covered about a fifth, and we were there for
huge.
Like 4 hours, 5 hours. So.
And then melting clocks became a common theme in Salvador Dali's work. So he's exploring the concept of time.
Melting away. Lots of sculptures of it as well.
Yeah. All sorts.
We've been to two, actually, Salvador Dali exhibitions. We went to one Belgium and one in
Amsterdam.
Yeah. They like him over there, don't they?
Yep. Dali himself was very eccentric, and he behaved in a grandiose manner. This sometimes brought more attention to his artwork than the actual art, so his behaviour, and this annoys some of his critics who think he's worth the time and the attention for his artwork rather than his behaviour.
Or think he's not worth the time and think he's just
his
gaming.
Work's rubbish. Halsman first met Dali in 1941 in the Surrealist Circle whilst living in Paris, and they later began to collaborate on photography in the late 1940s, and this led to the creation of the famous image in 1948. So, back to 1948. Halsman and Dali are collaborating, and it's in the form of a portrait. And it's Halsman's job to produce this. Together, they created an image entitled Dali Atomicus. So this image is what we're talking about, and this is one of the famous ones, famous image in history, and it's quite significant as well for photography. It's the most influential image of the collection that the pair produced, so they produced quite a few. When Halsman set out to shoot his now friend, he knew that a simple sit-down portrait would not be sufficient. He wanted his work to reflect Dali's character and personality, and he was also inspired by Dali's painting called Leda Atomica. This painting was completed in 1949, a year after the portrait was taken. It depicts Leda, the mythological queen of Sparta, with a swan. She's seated on a pedestal, and the swan is suspended to the left behind her. There are other objects also floating around Leda, such as an egg, a book, two stepping stools, and a set square. So I'm assuming at the time of the portrait, Dali was working on this painting, and
loves
it wasn't completed till a year later. He does love floating things. Halsman's inspiration from this painting led him to create an elaborate scene in order to shoot Dali. The scene included the original artwork of Leda Atomica, so it's in the background.
Oh, yeah.
A floating chair, three cats, a bucket of water, and an in-progress easel suspended by thin wires.
I was wondering, I presumed it was it was lifted by wires.
Yes.
And it's he's just jumping.
A mad image. Yes, he is.
Right.
To help with the now complicated procedure, Halsman roped in the help of his wife and his young daughter, Irene. As his assistants, the two were responsible for throwing in three cats and a bucket of water into the air
on his count.
So that was, one of them must have had the bucket of water and one of them must have had three cats.
Is the chair being held up as well?
I'm assuming that's on wire.
Yeah.
And they both, them two stood out of frame so they weren't captured.
Mm-hmm.
To complete the image, Darley jumped into the air at the same time. So it's a, the three of them have all got a task. So Darley jumps, one throws cats, one throws the water.
Isn't it strange how this, like, minus the cats and the water and the hanging chair and easel and stuff, this is what people do sometimes.
What, jump in photos? They were like,
we just take a picture of me while I jump.
Impossible to get pictures jumping. You always, always look
like
awful.
Friends of girls, like five girls in friends at school, they all jump in.
Oh, uni.
And there's always one who's too low.
Faye, who was on our podcast a while ago, my sister, recently went to Amsterdam. And in front of the Amsterdam sign, they decided to have a jumping picture. And I've never seen a more unflattering picture of Faye.
It's never, it is unflattering,
it's
isn't it?
Mid-jump. Terrible. Her dress blew up.
Oh, okay.
And her face is just in shock because she's realised.
Right.
Very funny.
We've not put that one on the Twitter.
No, we won't share that one. Sorry, everyone. So, there's a complicated procedure for shooting this.
Sounds a bit slapdash, if you ask me.
Well, yeah, but it's unlike anything they've ever done before.
It's live, isn't it?
Yeah, because if you think usually people sit there for a photograph.
No, it is
good,
yeah.
A bit mental.
I do like it.
Some stated that the completed image took 26 takes, and others stated it took 28, which I think is mad. I don't know how them cats, they must have been fighting them cats to get them back 26 times and throw them again.
Wet floor as well. They landed on a wet floor.
Yeah, must have been mad. So this is a small number of takes, really, to reach a composition that Halsman was happy with, but it's good that he was happy with it.
Yeah.
The image was also taken long before Photoshop was invented, which is another... Like, nowadays, that might be created on Photoshop. You could just pull that together in an afternoon. The final image was published in Life magazine, so it was a great success. Darley even painted an image directly onto the print ahead of publication, so extra publicity there. It was also a success for the development and advancement of portrait photography. Before Halsman, portrait photography had been stilted and often blurred. There'd been a lack of connection between the photographer and the subject, and it had been detached. In addition, his closely cropped, sharply focused portraits were infused with warmth and a sense of humour.
How did, like you just mentioned, they were blurred. How did they manage to get this? Because I'd imagine this would be blurred. Him jumping in the air.
I don't know. I didn't read anything about that bit.
Hmm.
I think by blurred, did they not mean like the background blurred?
Maybe, but a person in motion tends to give off motion blur.
They must have had a small aperture. High aperture, something to do with aperture.
Either a small or a high aperture.
Yeah, because one of them is what you need.
But it's all about light though as well, isn't it?
Yeah, because that lets the light in. Aperture. Mm. So Halsman had a real ability to make people feel comfortable in front of the camera, which helped his photography.
Those cats look very comfortable.
Yeah. His images inspired others to connect with and collaborate with their subjects, and it also refined portrait photography. This is not simply down to the image of Darley, but also through Halsman's photography of other highly influential individuals. Halsman, throughout his career, also photographed Marilyn Monroe, Alfred Hitchcock, Albert Einstein, Richard Nixon, Groucho Marx, Pablo Picasso, John F. Kennedy and Winston Churchill,
to name a few.
Yeah, he did like series of work. So at one point he did a series of comedians, which is where he did Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
He must have done quite a few artists. He did politicians as well.
Maya.
He became renowned for taking jump photographs, as we discussed before, of celebrities and political figures. He said, when you ask a person to jump, his attention is mostly directed towards the act of jumping and the mask falls so that the real person appears.
Yeah, it's sort of, it removes any pretense, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, you can't really pose a jumpy picture with your face. Halsman and Darley continued to collaborate, and they released a compendium of their collaborations in a book entitled Darley's Mustache. This was in 1954. This featured 36 different views of Darley's iconic mustache.
Too many.
But it's a great mustache.
It's not a bad mustache, I'm not going to lie. Yeah.
It's a good one.
Was Dali the one, did he walk through Paris with like an anteater or something, like a pet anteater?
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I don't know. Another famous collaboration between the pair, so Dali and Halsman, was called In Volputus Mors. This was an image of Dali beside a skull. It was a large skull that was composed of 7 nude people. For this image, it took Halsman 3 hours to arrange the models, and there have since been numerous reenactments of this image. Have you found out about this pet?
This pet, yeah, sorry, no,
it
he
was
did,
Dali.
Yeah, his little picture of him walking his pet anteater on the streets of Paris. It's just like, looks like it's dribbling everywhere.
I don't think I'd want a pet anteater.
I'm not sure if it's, I'm assuming it's real, yeah, it's just something I've heard previous. Mm. This is the only photo we have of it, though. By lots of it.
He also had a cat.
Looks more like a leopard.
Maybe an ocelot.
Or maybe, yeah. I just clicked on one. It says, for those who want to see Salvador Dali throw an anteater on an old lady.
Oh my gosh.
Bizarre.
No.
Sounds good.
In 1958, Halsman was listed in popular photography magazine's World's 10 Greatest Photographers. In 1975, he received the Life Achievement in Photography Award from the American Society of Magazine Photographers. For this society, he'd previously been elected as the first president in 1945. So he'd been president of that society, right. The first one. Pretty good. Pretty good.
Sounds
guy.
Sounds like he's had a pretty extraordinary career.
Yep. And I've added a section in Lorna's Movie Corner for this week.
I was going to bring up Movie Corner a second
and
ago.
I've done it. What was your movie corner?
It was going to be, as you mentioned, Salvador Dali, I thought immediately of the only film I've seen him in, which is Midnight in Paris.
Mm.
He, I believe, is played by Adrian Brody.
Oh, he's only the guy who plays the pianist.
Yeah, he's only in it briefly, but Owen Wilson's character in that film. I've mentioned Midnight in Paris on previous occasions, at least. So, no, yeah, he's in that film, Salvador Dali.
Cool. Well, this is a film about Halsman.
Okay.
In 2008, a British-Austrian drama film was created. It was written and directed by Joshua Sinclair, and it starred Patrick Swayze, Ben Silverstone, and Martine McCutcheon.
2008?
Yeah.
Patrick Swayze, when did he die? Just after?
He died, like, yeah. He wasn't able to come to the premiere.
Because he was dead?
Yep.
Right.
It's loosely based on a part of Halsman's life.
What's it called?
Oh. It's called Jump. It's called Jump with an exclamation mark.
Jump, okay.
Yeah. It's got a 6.2 out of 10 rating on IMDb.
Right.
But,
never heard of it.
No, don't look it up because
okay.
I'm about to ruin what it's about.
Okay.
Do you want me to ruin it? Because
yeah,
this is
yeah,
about
go on.
Halsman's life.
Okay.
So, it's loosely based on a part of his life, which is the murder of his father, which he was charged for.
Oh, wow.
When he was about 20. And he went to prison for it.
So this was previous?
Yeah, before his photography career, he was charged with the murder of his father. He had a tough life.
Well, yeah, did he deny? Did he accept it? What happened?
I don't think he did it. I think he denied it.
Oh, right, okay.
And then I think he got out after a bit. But he had loads of famous people working on his case.
Oh, really?
Like, even Albert Einstein was interested in his case.
Like Kim Kardashian's dad.
No, Robert Kardashian wasn't alive then.
Yeah.
So, that was my report on my movie corner.
Very good. Very good movie corner. He sounds like a really interesting guy. Both of them sound like really interesting people. I've just been having a quick look again at the image. And I really like, if you are, as we are, browsing the image, you'll see two cats that look like they're sort of having a little scrap midair, whilst the other looks like it's surfing on a bit of ice.
Oh, it looks like they're having a good time.
But I also feel quite a lot of that because he's very high. That
also,
cat.
Great capturing of the water.
I know, that's what I mean. That's why I was really impressed by it.
But
there's no blur or anything.
Cats are all right falling, and also they've got 9 lives.
That's part of that is true. Half of that's true.
They have got 9 lives.
They're all right at falling. Depends from where. I actually, speaking of cats falling, I saw a video, or a guy showed me at work, a video of a cat jumping out of like a bedroom window onto a trampoline. Have you seen this video?
No.
It's been doing the rounds. Look it up. It's because it's sort of looking. It's like, I was like, don't jump. But the guy's just filming it. Like, he does this every day. He jumps and he sort of bounces on the trampoline. And he's all right in the end.
Oh, good, good.
But I was a bit worried for this. Like,
in a bit of shock.
Yeah, it was like Action Man Cat. G.I. Joe Man Cat. Very good report. So
thank you.
Obviously, you got that from the Times 100. That's what you briefly meant, like you mentioned earlier. Is Times ran a an article about? Oh well, they have a whole website.
I wouldn't
about it,
even
don't
go. I just searched for famous
photos.
Yeah, yeah, and there was a list of like 25, and then I got to this one and was like,
"That's
this will do."
Yeah. Well, this is on the. Wait, you'd mentioned it to me, and I.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't found my one last week from that, but then I went looking for that this week because I was intrigued because you'd mentioned it.
Yeah.
There's some really good ones. Obviously, I came across this going back to the 1800s, some of the really early ones. Even some of the most recent ones are really good. There's one of that I really like, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's when the White House, Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton are there, and they're all in a little room, and they're all watching the assassination of Osama bin Laden.
Really?
Yeah, like you can't see what they're watching, but you can see like all the, there's like 15 people in this tiny room, and obviously it was like,
what are the faces like?
They're intense. Because it was a White House photographer.
Captured anyway, so you have to.
Yeah, but they're not posing for a photo. It's during this like assignment of. Well, it was zero dark 30, so it was like 12:30, and they're all sat there in the White House watching this like huge moment in history, in American history. So that's a really interesting photo, and a lot of them are to do with war and sad things like that. There's a few of the more recent ones, especially really graphic and really like things that I haven't seen.
Well, last week we had quite a political week.
Mm.
And so you talked about like Che Guevara, and then we had like a protest. And this week, I just thought I'd go. Totally
well, yeah.
Random.
So that's what I tried to do. So I actually found a couple that I wanted to talk about. We mentioned a couple last week, but I didn't want to do the one about napalm in the Vietnam War.
Oh no, it's too sad.
There was also the Vietnamese police officer shooting someone.
Yeah, the Viet Cong one. Also too sad.
And then. Another one that piqued my interest, but I didn't do it, was the Hindenburg disaster. Have you seen the photo of that? As the Hindenburg, the big Zeppelin
crashed. No, I've not seen that.
Which is an interesting story in itself. That that is a photo of that.
Also
which,
very sad.
So I did choose a sad topic, but it's not war. It's not a big... it is a big disaster, but it's on a different level.
Okay.
Because there weren't that many happy ones, really.
No. Because nobody likes a happy story.
Well, the happy ones are, yeah, you tend, the only really happy ones we came across was sort of the Marilyn Monroe one, which I didn't really want to cover, and the VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, is it like a sailor and someone kissing?
In New York?
Yeah,
in
kissing.
Yeah, it's not VE Day, it's VJ Day.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. And I just wanted to mention another thing I was thinking about when you were doing your report. One of my favourite photos, you mentioned Photoshop.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favourite photos is actually a Photoshopped image. One of a few of the most famous photos in the world, a few of the most expensive photos in the world are Photoshopped images. So one that I really like is called 99 Cents, I think. Let me start to search it. Yeah, so...
Oh, you've shown me this one before.
99 Cents by Andreas Gursky, and that's loads of different 99 cent shops. They're all photoshopped together and to make this huge, like, rows and rows of shops. And that's this guy, like, I don't know much about photography, but he, that is a very famous photo. And then his photo of the Rhine.
That's the one, yeah. I remember it.
Oh, at least at one point was the most. It's called the Rhine 2 from 1999. Is the
Most expensive. And it doesn't look expensive.
Well, that's actually like a lot of different parts of the Rhine.
Put together.
Photoshopped together or put together.
It's handy Photoshop, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if it was on Photoshop, but at least it was...
put together.
Put together. I'm trying to find out how much that went for, but I'll find out on the... Let you know. But I find them really interesting because they're like... split. It's all basic photography. That's splitting the canvas into like three sections.
Mm-hmm.
But look up those photos and let us know what you think about them. Because I really like those. But I know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about another very famous photo. And that is the migrant's mother. You heard about this?
No. Well, I know it.
Potentially. I'll get an image up for you while I just explain. So, this is a very famous photo from, as I mentioned earlier, from the 20th century.
Yes,
America.
I saw it when I came across my research.
And it is one I've come across before, but it was one that I've sort of passed by and not really noticed among sort of the ones we mentioned last week and a few others. So I thought I'd have a look into it, if not for you guys, but for me, to see what it was all about. So there was a lady called Dorothea. Do you pronounce his name Dorothea?
I've never seen it.
No?
I would say Dorothea.
Yeah, Dorothea Lange. Or Lange. I call her I'll just call her Dorothea. Dorothea Lange. I'll call her Lange. She was a photographer. She'd been operating a successful portrait studio.
Oh, interesting that she was a photographer as well then.
No, the woman. No,
she
that's not the woman. She is the photographer. I'm starting
Got
with
it.
The photographer.
Sorry.
No, no. She... people taking the
Sorry,
photos.
Sorry, I jumped the gun there because I know half the story.
All right, okay. You know half the story of this one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Apologies, everyone.
Yeah, so she is...
She is not the woman in the picture.
No, she's the one taking the photo.
Yep.
But I thought you'd say it's interesting that all these people who have done these famous photos have progressed to that from a different starting point. So she started as a successful portrait studio. She had a successful portrait
studio.
Oh,
that's definitely not a portrait studio.
They also obviously had fashion
But I guess it's just
background.
Your own personal development.
Yeah.
You never stop, are you?
PDP. So...
It's not a plan.
So, she had this studio in San Francisco in 1919.
San Francisco.
But...
Francisco.
She was moved... a bit later on, by the homeless and unemployed she saw standing in the breadlines as the Great
by
Depression.
She was inspired.
She
like,
was moved
she was
by
intrigued.
She was moved emotionally.
Right, yeah.
Seeing these people standing in breadlines as the Great Depression took hold, 1929.
Yeah.
Wall Street crash and all that.
Was her business still successful at this time?
That's what I thought as well, actually. That was my first thinking. Because
if
thought,
I'm in the Great Depression, I would not have a portrait.
But I guess, I'm not sure.
Well, the rich get richer and they might need them, so.
So she decided to begin to photograph the homeless and the unemployed. In 1936, so I think she started doing this off her own back, like no one was paying her to do this. And in 1936, she was employed by the US government's Farm Security Administration, the FSA.
Of course they've got a Farm Security Administration.
Program, the FSA program.
Oh, is it the alphabet agencies? Is that an alphabet agency?
I'm not sure.
No, it doesn't work, ignore me.
No. This program had been formed during the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
In order to raise awareness of and provide aid to impoverished farmers. And the hope was that by bringing attention to their struggles, by documenting them, it would mean such events would never reoccur.
Recur.
It's quite interesting, that. I like that there's a big purpose behind taking these photos. It means that in the future it won't recur or reoccur. But also at that moment, if they can show these people struggling, then they'll send aid to help them out. She was actually in California. She was on a trip. She was concluding this trip. She'd been travelling around the different farms and everything, taking photos.
Mm-hmm.
And she stopped in Nipomo, California. I read in one account that she had driven past this sort of crude-looking sign which said Pea Pickers Camp. And she'd carry on for about 20 miles. And then she decided to turn back. Like something... like
was pulling her back. It's a gut feeling.
Yeah.
Spirits.
So in this pea pickers camp, she came across a woman named Florence Owens Thompson. Good name.
That is a Flo.
Flo, yeah.
Yeah.
Came across Flo and her 7 children, and they were in the camp. And this camp was filled with field workers whose livelihoods had been devastated by the failure of the pea crops.
So, was Flo a pea picker?
So this is what I thought, and then not exactly. So I've got a few quotes by a couple of different people. As Lang described Thompson's situation, she said she and her children had been living on frozen vegetables from the field and wild birds the children caught. The pea crop had frozen, there was no work, yet they could not move on, for she had just sold the tyres from the car to buy food. So this is quite a famous, this is sort of, when you search it, this is what people say, like, she sold the tyres off a car, her children couldn't eat, they were eating literally, like,
frozen veg.
And things that they, like, birds
frozen
that they caught.
Frozen veg are the worst as well.
Well, yeah, it was the sort of the rain and everything, well, it's freezing rain, basically.
Yeah.
Also known as ice. And, had been destroying all the crops. She also said, so this is basically how she was in the camp, and then this is what happened. This is how she recalled it in 1960. I saw and approached the hungry and desperate mother as if drawn by a magnet. I do not remember how I explained my presence or my camera to her, but I do remember she asked me no questions. I made 5 exposures, working closer and closer from the same direction. I did not ask her name or all her history. She told me her age, that she was 32.
She looks so much older.
She said that they had been living on frozen vegetables from the surrounding fields and birds that the children killed. She had just sold the tyres from her car to buy food. There she sat in that lean-to tent with her children huddled around her and seemed to know that my pictures might help her, and so she helped me. There was a sort of equality about it, and that's from Popular Photography, February 1960. So if you haven't seen this photo, it's this mother looking off into the distance with her children sort of huddling around her, like, it's quite close up and they're sort
of
hiding.
Yeah, you can just see
her.
The mum, really. But my first thought, because I when I've seen it, it said that she was 32, and I was like, oh my gosh, she looks about 50.
I wouldn't say 50, it just looks like maybe a little bit younger. But she, yeah, she's having a tough time. However, Thompson, Flo, later contested Lang's, Lang's account.
She contested.
So apparently,
what, in a bad way?
So a reporter interviewed her in the 1970s, and she insisted that she and Lang did not speak to each other, nor did she sell the tyres of her car. Thompson said that Lang had either confused her for another farmer or embellished what she had understood of her situation in order to make a better story.
I hope it's not that, because that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I think it seems, well, from what I've read, it seems like she may have, because she spoke to a lot of different people.
She was
taking
confused.
A ton of photos, so she may have.
Yeah, because unless you're writing it down, yeah. Like, and it's a bit rude to write as someone talks.
And also, yeah, she's not getting the photo then and writing on the back of this photo, this is what happened to this person, sort of thing. She hasn't got the name of a lot of the people either, so yeah. I don't think that if you're meeting a lot of people, it can be easy to get confused. One of the photos, because like I said, she took quite a few, or took 5, I think. One of the photos she took was widely circulated to magazines and newspapers and became a symbol of the plight of migrant farm workers during the Great Depression. It has since become one of the most familiar images of the 20th century. Centuries? Of the 20th century. Of all the 20th. 20 centuries.
Struggling with your words,
yeah.
Aren't you? At
the time, Lang informed the authorities of the struggles of these people at the encampment, and they sent £20,000 of food for them. That was the purpose of the whole thing, really.
Yeah, it's pretty good. What if it went off?
What do you mean? Oh, the food.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's all right. Sell-by dates are made up, according to my mother.
Yeah, my mum as well. Migrant mother shows Thompson's children cowering behind her for protection, with their faces hidden as their mother gazes distractedly into the distance. So obviously we know it's Florence Thompson now, but for decades we had no idea who this woman was. Like
how
Lang
did she
said.
Get found out then?
That's what I'm going on to. So as Lang said, she didn't get the name. I think Lang died in 1965. She was a little bit older, I think.
Yeah.
She
had a well-established career.
She did, yeah. So Lang never asked her name, never asked Thompson's name, and by the time the photo appeared in a local newspaper, the family had moved on to the next town. In 1978, a reporter from the Modesto Bee, which is, I'm assuming, a newspaper, found the migrant mother, tracking her down to a trailer park outside Modesto, California.
How on earth?
That's what I thought, and I couldn't figure it out.
Did he
I don't know.
Or she track that?
I'm not sure.
Track her down?
No, not entirely sure.
Unless they knew it was taken in that pea picking place. And he went to loads of people that he knew was there and said, do you know this person?
Maybe.
Do you know her name? And then he gets her name and then he looks in the phone book and then he's like, Flo, where are you, kid? It's a massive area, though. That's
I know,
ridiculous.
It is a massive area, yeah. So that is when we learned that her name was Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, she was 75 years old.
Oh, but she's still alive. That's a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Florence, a little bit of backstory that we learned about, was born Florence Leona Christie, was a Cherokee, and was born in a teepee in Indian Territory, Oklahoma, in 1903.
Oh, I love Oklahoma.
She married at 17, moved to California for some farm work and mill work. At 28 and pregnant with her sixth child, her husband died of tuberculosis.
But she had seven children.
Oh my goodness. Maybe she had six children.
Where's the next baby daddy?
I don't know. I don't know if she did have seven. I did read that, but other ones didn't mention how many children she had. So maybe she had
six.
The
one I saw said seven.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe that was her seventh child at that point. I'm not sure. Thompson worked odd jobs to keep her children fed, and for most of the 1930s, she was an itinerant farmhand, picking whatever was in season. During cotton harvest, she would apparently put her babies in bags and carry them along with her as she worked down the rows of cotton. She earned 50 cents per 100 pounds picked, and she generally picked about 450 to 500 pounds a day.
That is massive.
She said, I didn't even weigh 100 pounds. That's what she talked to a number of different reporters, I think, over the years. For a while, she and her children lived under a bridge, and she talked about this, and she said, when Steinbeck wrote in The Grapes of Wrath about those people living under the bridge at Bakersfield, at one time we lived under that bridge. It was the same story. Didn't he even have a tent then, just a ratty old quilt? So in John Steinbeck's book, The Grapes of Wrath, is people living in very poor conditions during the Great Depression. Steinbeck. You hate John Steinbeck?
I like him.
All right. And this was literally, he was telling like the sort of story of their lives and their livelihood. Apparently, Thompson was actually driving from LA to Watsonville when her car broke down and she managed to get it towed to the pea pickers' camp. And it was repaired, and they just had to leave when Lang arrived, or they were getting ready to leave.
Why
when Lang
was she
arrived.
Going to Watsonville? Do you know?
Probably for another
for
job.
More
yeah.
work.
Yeah, but it's quite interesting because when you sort of hear it, because this was after a bit of digging, but on the face of it, it seems like she was at that camp working, and
did she stay there?
No, so I think she moved on.
Oh, so she was literally there just for that day, and that image has become.
Well,
famous.
I don't know if she was just there for that day, but yeah, she was there. For what seems like a short period of time, maybe. Thompson apparently was not eager to have a family photographed and exhibited as specimens of poverty, which I think is fair enough. But there were people starving in that camp. One of Thompson's daughters later recalled, and Lang convinced her that the image would educate the public about what was going on, and about the hard-working but poor people like herself. Which I think is fair enough. I think it's an admirable thing to do.
And also it's just having a photo taken.
Yeah.
It's not too heavy.
I know, but I don't know. She didn't want to...
I understand not having the kids in. I also understand if she didn't want to. I was asked today to be on a picture at work and I said no.
Why?
Just didn't want to. Just not feeling it.
They could have done with the young employee of the year.
No.
Being a part of that. Thompson moved to Modesto in 1945 and worked in a hospital. She would work 16-hour days, 7 days a week. And she told NBC in 1979, I worked in hospitals, I attended bar, I worked in the field, so I'd done a little bit of everything to make a living for my kids. So Lang, so that's sort of Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Lang, the photographer, due in part to her work with the FSA.
The program.
The farm. Program. She became known as a pioneer of documentary film, documentary photography, a classification that she actually disliked because she felt the term did not reflect the passionate social motivations that fueled her work.
There's a reason behind it all. I think she would like that, though.
What do you mean?
Today, if she was known as a documentary photographer, I feel like she'd like it. I feel like documentary filmmakers often tackle an issue that they're very passionate about. I think it gives you the... Saying you're making a film or you're taking images gives you the in to get what you want. Because I couldn't go up to someone and just be like, I'm making this film. I'm making this film. Can I take a picture of you for this?
Mm.
They get in places where you won't usually be able to access because you're known as a documentary filmmaker or photographer.
Okay. Do you think that, therefore, the idea of a documentary photographer has changed? Do you think that at the time it was maybe more passive? And she's saying,
She doesn't want like her work to be credited, discredited.
She wants to say that there's some passion, like she's doing it for a reason. She's doing this for social like reasons.
Yeah, which I think
today, rather than I'm just documenting these people who are poor, she's saying I'm documenting them because I'm trying to help them.
Yeah, so today the perfect example is Michael Moore. He's a documentary filmmaker and he's always making a film for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and documentary film has become you're making it for a reason. You're not just often documenting it just to...
Yeah, like Blackfish. Got SeaWorld, essentially.
Sea Land. Sea Land podcast. Love Sea Land. So, this photo, the migrant mother, helped a lot in making Lang's reputation. Earned her a Guggenheim Fellowship.
Ooh, a Guggenheim.
Guggenheim. She would actually give this prestigious award up shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor and instead recorded the forced evacuation of Japanese Americans from the West Coast, something I have little knowledge of.
Interesting. I've actually tried to do a bit of research on Japanese Americans following the Second World War and in the Second World War.
Oh, really?
I think it would make a very interesting
topic. Yeah, I had no idea, and I just briefly brushed the side of that topic sort of thing as I looked at this.
Very interesting.
And it was interesting, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
In 1952, she co-founded the photographic magazine Aperture, what we mentioned earlier.
Oh, it still exists, does it not?
I'm not sure.
I think it does, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. She died at the age of 70. In San Fran, California, in 1965, which is what I said.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
3 months later, MoMA, mentioned it, the Museum of Modern Art.
New York City.
In New York City, mounted a retrospective show of her work, which Lang herself had actually helped to curate.
Oh, that's cool.
In 2003, she was inducted into National Women's Hall of Fame.
She has
an elementary school named after her in Nipomo, California, near where the photograph was taken, town, Nipomo, or whatever it is. And she was inducted into California Hall of Fame as well.
I want to be in the women's one.
Okay.
But I'm not from America. Do you think we have a British one?
Yeah, probably. The Thompson clan.
Yep.
Thompson family. Eventually grew to 10 children. They worked their way into the middle class.
Wait, so she had more kids?
I'm presuming so.
Oh, good.
Florence Thompson never felt comfortable in a conventional home. Even after her children bought her a house, she chose to live in a trailer.
Oh.
And apparently she said, I need to have wheels under me. Don't know if that's just a quote that I read. Couldn't attribute it to any website or whatever, though. 1983, Thompson had a stroke. Her children, unable to pay the hospital, used her identity as the migrant mother to raise $15,000 in donations. The money helped to defray her medical bills, but she herself gained nothing, and she died soon after a stroke.
But I think she gained a lot because her family then didn't have a burden.
Yeah, definitely. But a few years earlier than this, a reporter had asked Thompson about the life that she'd managed to eke out for her family.
Eek, posh word.
She apparently spoke plainly with no sentimentality. We just existed, she said. Anyway, we lived, we survived, let's put it that way. We never had a lot. Oh, this was her daughter, McIntosh, said. We never had a lot, but she always made sure we had something. She didn't eat sometimes, but she made sure us children ate. And I just think it's quite interesting how, like, she's this famous, it's sort of similar to the Tank Man in a way. She's this really famous image, her and her children, this symbol of these hard-working but poor people during the Great Depression. But it didn't benefit her, really.
And she didn't do it for the image.
No, she didn't, but it's just a weird contrast, I always think, when you see these really famous images and you're like, wow, everyone knows this, but the actual woman in the image and her family have not seen any benefit from this.
Yeah.
Really. Like, obviously, they were doing it, like I said, the FSA were doing it for a reason, trying to get people
support
food and everything, but
farmers and stuff.
I just think it's a strange thing.
It is, yeah.
And now, obviously, Lang doing a great job and everything, but I always think it's weird because they're like, she's in the Women's Hall of Fame, she's got a school.
She's credited.
She's got
and
a school named after her.
Like, going, taking pictures and then going back to probably like a hotel room or something.
But nothing against her at all, but just a strange world that we're living.
It is because, last week with Tankman, he's probably dead.
And
the
people
are
winning awards and all sorts. It's interesting. And that's what hit me when it said that Lang had an elementary school named after in Napomo, California, which is...
Why is it not named after Florence?
Well, yeah, that's what I thought. But Lang did a lot of great stuff, and I'm not going to discredit her, I think.
Yeah, and she did want to be known for a social...
And she was a...
Movement.
A pioneer in that photography, so... Yeah, that's sort of a story of two incredible women in two different ways, in a way.
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah. So that's my report on Migrant Mother or The Migrant Mother as well.
Very good.
A bit sadder again than yours, wasn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Not that
There
sad.
Weren't that many cats being thrown into photographs.
No.
Not a lot of jumping in that one, yeah.
No.
But I didn't have a movie corner. You can watch East of Eden.
You could watch Of Mice and Men.
Yeah, two John Steinbeck book adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has got...
that guy from CSI in...
Gary... something.
Yeah.
And the other one's got James Dean in it.
Oh, right. Sorry, that weren't where you're going.
That guy from CSI, I was like, that's not James Dean. Two good films, actually. East of Eden's quite a good film from 1992, maybe, early 90s.
Of Mice and Men just makes me
That's
sad.
What I meant, sorry. Of Mice and Men from the early 90s. And East of Eden from 1950s.
No way.
What?
The film must have come out quite soon after he wrote the book, then. Because.
Yep.
Oh, no. John Steinbeck must be dead now.
Yeah. So the film came out in 1955.
Yeah,
and it's
sorry,
based on a
I'm
1952
wrong.
Novel, so only 3 years later.
Yeah, and he went travelling in 1962.
Oh, did it?
And wrote Travels with Charlie. And that's when he was getting a bit older.
Right.
So, yeah.
Of Mice and Men was published in 1937. Came out in 1992. Gary Sinise and John Malkovich. There you go.
Gary's the best.
I don't know. Why do I know that came out in 1992? What's wrong with me?
It's a weird fact.
Anyway, there's our movie corner. Go watch those. Go watch Jump.
Yeah.
Story of James Hollis?
Phil.
Phil Hollis?
Phil Phil Holzman.
That's what I said. James Hollis.
Who's James?
I don't know.
Hollis?
Phil Holzman.
Philip Holzman.
That's what I said. Philippe, actually.
Philip or Philippe, we're not sure.
So, come back next week and we'll have another podcast report.
Yeah.
All ready for you. We're actually recording this one pretty early. The day after the last one was released. This is a Thursday. And that's because we go on Idiots on Tour to Paris.
Yes.
Over the weekend.
Look
so,
out for some pictures.
We'll try and get some pictures.
We're
Versailles.
Heading to Versailles.
Where we our most popular podcast episode.
Yep.
Louis the 14th in the Palace of Versailles, which is episode number 2. Relate to that, obviously. We'll get some photos up there. And where else are we going that's interesting? Other places. The Eiffel Tower we'll see, which is links into...
The Flying Taylor
episode from 52 or something.
Very good.
Look at that. I've got some Paris related. Zelda Fitzgerald went to
we
Paris.
We probably won't have a picture of anything to do with Zelda.
We might do. We'll see.
we'll keep an eye out.
So you can keep an eye out on all of that through our social media.
Yes, check it out.
At Idiot History Pod on the Twitter. At idiothistorypod@gmail.com if you want to email us. And we'll be posting on Facebook at Idiots Talk History.
And the same on Instagram.
But you can see all that in the show notes below. Low.
That's horrible.
Anything else? Thanks for listening.
Yep.
Come back next week. Tell a friend. Maybe leave a review on iTunes, whatever podcast that you're listening to us on.
We'll speak to you soon.
And we'll speak to you soon. We'll have another fascinating topic.
Yeah.
All right, have a good week. Bye.
Bye.